Was Martin Luther King's assassination 50 years ago the result of a high-level conspiracy? Who was James Earl Ray, and what role did he play in the assassination? Who was Lloyd Jowers, and what role did he play in the plot to kill King? What motives did J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI have in seeking the death of the civil rights leader? Why would the media downplay, if not completely distort, the facts surrounding the assassination of Martin Luther King, even if members of the King family were critical of the official story? On this week's Global Research News Hour, on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the death of the famous civil rights leader, we spend the hour discussing the evidence that there was a high-level conspiracy to assassinate King and conceal the truth about it. Our guest is noted human rights lawyer, author, and King family friend, William Pepper. On this week's program, The Plot to Kill Martin Luther King, a conversation with William Pepper. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 6th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. A precipitous decline in household wealth, real wages, and quality of life is framed by the government and corporate media as prosperity and stability. This scenario is being challenged with the stark reality of rising racial and class tensions in the U.S. and the escalation of a war being carried out both domestically and abroad. Dr. King saw the situation clearly when, in 1966, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference took its campaign to Chicago and later Cleveland the following year. It is this aspect of the civil rights movement which is routinely overlooked by the establishment, which heaps false praise on the leader after he was brutally isolated and assassinated at the aegis of the racist state. Drawing the links between institutional racism, economic exploitation, and war is important in understanding the struggle of the 1960s and the present. That comes from the article, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., 50 Years Later, The Struggle Against Racism, War, and Poverty Continues, by Abayomi Azikiwe, posted April 4th. The Americans couldn't win in Vietnam. With voices like that of MLK to contend with, the home front could not hold. Yet, it was several years before America finally withdrew its claws from the stricken country. And so it promises to be with Syria, where no serious commentator believes that Assad can be prevented from regaining control of his country, as Ho did with his. But still, America insists on prolonging the pain by attempting to colonize Syria's oil-rich Wild East, by forming new mercenary militias with tame tribes, by conducting relentless information and economic warfare. That comes from the article, Martin Luther King, Lesson for Today, Militarism and Economic Exploitation, Blatant Racism at Home and Imperialism Abroad, by Peter Ford, posted April 3rd, originally appearing at Beloved Syria. Despite the vastly more perilous state of our planet, many people and organizations around the world are following in the footsteps of Gandhi, King, and other nonviolent luminaries like Silo, and are engaged in what is effectively a last-ditch stand to end the violence and put humanity on a path to peace, justice, and sustainability. Let me tell you about some of these people and organizations and invite you to join them. In Bolivia, Nora Cobero works with the Movimiento Humanista. The movement has many programs, including the Convergence of Cultures, which aims to facilitate and stimulate true dialogue, oriented towards the search for common points present in the hearts of different peoples and individuals to promote the relationship between different cultures and to resist discrimination and violence. another program, World Without Wars and Violence, emerged in 1994 and was presented for the first time internationally in 1995 at the Open Meeting of Humanism held in Chile at the University of Santiago. That comes from the article, Nonviolence or Nonexistence, The Legacy of Martin Luther King Jr. by Robert J. Burroughs, posted April 2nd. We should carefully reflect on MLK's message to the world. MLK understood the relationship between America's war agenda and social justice and civil rights in America. Quote, "No one who has any concern for the integrity and life of America today can ignore the present war, Vietnam," unquote. One cannot be a civil rights leader without taking a stance against U.S.-led wars. That was from a new introduction by Michelle Chosudovsky to a transcription of Beyond Vietnam, Silence is Betrayal, Martin Luther King's historic 1967 speech, posted April 4th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. The official story of the assassination of civil rights leader Martin Luther King is as follows. Martin King had been staying at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee, with his friend and colleague, Ralph Abernathy. On April 4, 1968, around 6:01 p.m. local time, a single bullet from a high-powered rifle shot him in the face and brought him down. An ambulance took him to St. Joseph's Hospital, where he was pronounced dead an hour later. The shooter was identified as one James Earl Ray, an escaped convict, apparently motivated by racism, who had taken the shot from the rooming house across the street from the Lorraine Motel. He then fled the scene and the country, but was captured in London's Heathrow Airport and extradited back to the United States. Ray pleaded guilty on the advice of his lawyer and was sentenced to a 99-year life sentence. This account has come under question. In fact, much of the public is generally unaware that there was a wrongful death civil trial almost 20 years ago in which members of the King family contested the official story. The trial conclusively found that James Earl Ray could not possibly have been the killer. On the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the King assassination, we'll be spending the hour discussing what really happened, why this truth has been concealed, and what this historic episode teaches us about the prospects for confronting power in our society, as King tried to do. Our guest is William Pepper. He is a barrister admitted to the bar in the United Kingdom and in jurisdictions throughout the United States. He was a friend of King's in the final year of his life. He came to believe that James Earl Ray was a fall guy in the murder of Martin King to cover up for the involvement of a broad conspiracy involving the Memphis Police Department, the FBI, and the local mafia. He represented the King family at the wrongful death civil trial and has written now three books on the King assassination: Orders to Kill, The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King; An Act of State, The Execution of Martin Luther King; and his latest, from 2016, The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. He joined us from New York City. We asked Dr. William Pepper to give us some background on how he came to be associated with Martin King.
I had been a journalist in Vietnam, and when I returned, I published an article in Ramparts magazine called The Children of Vietnam that dealt with American war crimes and some of the reality of the war. He was a subscriber to Ramparts, saw the piece, read the piece, was very distressed by it, and asked to meet with me. And so I met him and opened up more files to him, and he was devastated by what his government was doing. I then worked with him that last year of his life on the for the National Conference for New Politics, he asked me to run that. And we were looking to have a King Spock ticket, which was subverted at a convention in Labor Day weekend in Chicago.
You're talking about Dr. Benjamin Spock.
Yes, it was King and Spock, Benjamin Spock.
Okay.
That was the projection for the ticket. Yeah.
Yeah. And, of course, the assassination was taking place, it took place on April 4th, 1968, and this would have been just right in the midst of the U.S. presidential primary season.
Yes, it was. It was. But we didn't have that third-party ticket because the convention with 5,000 delegates was subverted and disrupted by government agents who made it impossible to run that kind of ticket because they the attending Black Caucus, which were in small part but disruptive part, Blackstone Rangers, began to introduce anti-Semitic resolutions, which drove away all of the northern liberal Jewish money. So it cut the legs out from under the potential campaign.
Interesting. Now, when it came to the assassination, when you originally accepted the official story that James Earl Ray was the lone killer. You know, he had been in a rooming house across from the hotel where King had been staying, and or at least that's where he had had a room checked out. And, you know, that was the official line. He pled guilty in 1969 and was sentenced to 99 years. At what point did you start to doubt that official take on events?
Well, I began to doubt it when I interrogated Ray for 5 hours in August of 78. Abernathy wanted me to do that. He and I and Jim Lawson and a psychiatrist, a friend of mine, attended that interrogation at the Brushing Mountain Penitentiary in August. And Ray raised a number of issues and a number of facts that conflicted with the official story. And so I decided at that point to begin to look into it and see what I could find out for myself. And that's really when this 40-year investigation began, following the interrogation of Ray. I would go to see him periodically and get questions and ask questions and try to get more information from him. And he kept asking me to represent him, and I refused to do so until 1988. It was 10 years after I met him, because I had to be certain that he was... We all knew he was not the shooter. That was evident from the interrogation that I conducted in 78. But what we didn't know was what role he might have played in terms of the assassination. And it took 10 years for me to be convinced that he was an unknowing patsy.
Mm. Now, adjacent to this idea that he wasn't the shooter, there's the specter that there was a conspiracy involving a lot of different players that that had conspired to kill King and put James Earl Ray in this patsy position. Did you come to this realization about the same time, or was there as you continued to interview James Earl Ray that the specter of a conspiracy started to come out?
Well, the more I dug into issues in Memphis, the more I became gradually convinced that this guy knew nothing about the plan, but was really just being set up to take the fall. And that became very clearly evident to me as I worked in Memphis.
Mm. So tell us a little bit about the man himself. He had actually been serving a prison sentence and then escaped, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So you discovered at some point that there had actually he had had some help in escaping from the penitentiary where he had been detained, right?
Yes, that was arranged. J. Edgar Hoover sent $25,000 into Memphis with Clyde Tolson, his number two. And Tolson was always the intermediary, meeting with the Dixie Mafia people and government and police people who were involved in the assassination. With respect to Ray, they sent in $25,000 with Tolson. The head of the Dixie Mafia, Russell Atkins, took the $25,000 to the prison and gave it to the warden to pay him for arranging the escape. James knew nothing about it, but they had profiled him as an ideal candidate, Patsy candidate, and then they arranged for this escape. And then they kept him on a leash and knew where he was and kept him under control, moved him around to have him where he needed to be as a patsy. So I learned this because the 16-year-old son of the Dixie Mafia leader, who went along with his father to give the money to the warden. So he was able to confirm that.
Mm. And over that period, so when he left, when he escaped, that was in 67, correct? Less than a year before the assassination. And what was he doing in that period between his escape and the time he had been given that access to that room at the rooming house?
Well, he was trying to get out of North America and trying very very hard to get into Africa, and so that was his goal. He started to head toward Canada, and he picked up a job, and he had a job in a restaurant for a period of time, and gathered a little bit of money. Then he went into Canada, and it was in Montreal that he met Raoul, who offered to help get him papers and get him out of the country and keep him out. But he asked him to do certain, he would have to do certain things for Raoul before that. And Raoul gave him money to buy a car and pretty much kept him on a string until they were ready to use him.
Hmm. And there was a period where he was up in Canada, right?
Yes, this is in Montreal, where he met Raoul.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Raoul. He's a mysterious figure that that seems to be a very important player in this whole drama.
Well, he was the handler for James. He was a Portuguese immigrant. I believe he was involved with military intelligence in Africa for Portugal. He came to the United States and had certain connections both with organized crime and with the government. And he was involved in activities for the government, and he was the natural person they selected to take control and handle James, and make sure that he was where they wanted him to be. So he played a significant, very significant role in the assassination. Yes.
Mm. Now I understand he ended up among the identities that James Earl Ray ended up adopting was one that would have given him a certain amount of protection in the event that some, you know, there was some intervention by the law enforcement that might have upset the plans to put him in that patsy role. Could you talk about that identity that he adopted?
James was given the identity of a man who worked in a weapons warehouse outside of Toronto in Canada. The identity was Eric S. Galt, G-A-L-T. They gave him that identity because if James was ever stopped for for speeding or anything else, that any police check would show that he had the special security clearance, and he would be let go very, very easily. So that's why he was given the gold identity. There also was somewhat of a physical resemblance between Gault and James.
Now, what can you tell us about James Earl Ray's activities while he was in Memphis, leading up to that fateful day, April 4th?
Well, he came into town as he was instructed by Raoul. He had bought a weapon, and he had turned it over to Raoul the night before on the outskirts of Memphis. Then he came into Memphis that day and parked the car in front of a rooming house as he was instructed. And he went upstairs, brought his belongings upstairs, and rented a room from Bessie Brewer, who ran the rooming house. And it was a room that had a window overlooking the Lorraine, but it was a small room, and he would not spend much time there because Raoul would tell him that he was meeting with some gun sellers, and he was needed privacy to meet with them to conduct purchases of weapons and things. But Ray was not in the room a great deal. But the room was used, so we learned, as a staging place for the shooting. And the shooter and his spotter went down and met Lloyd Jowers and Earl Clark in the bushes in the back of that rooming house.
Now, we know that James Earl Ray was nowhere near the crime scene when the assassination took place. What was he doing?
Yeah, that's right. He remembered that he had a flat spare tire. And that if Raoul took the car, as he thought he was going to, and had any problems with a flat tire, there was a flat spare as well, he wouldn't be very happy. So James decided to go to a gas station and to some blocks away and to have that spare tire repaired. He was seen heading in that direction by two men who came out of Jim's Grill and who saw him driving toward that gas station. That evidence was buried deep in a file drawer and never referred to or used. When James was up at the gas station waiting, he heard sirens. They had begun already to send the ambulance down to the area where he was to meet. So he took off from the gas station, decided not to wait, and drove back toward the rooming house. But as he came up to the rooming house, he was waved away by the police, and he then just decided that he should make a break and head out of there and really go to Atlanta, where he was intended to go earlier at Raoul's suggestion. So he left the Memphis area and headed south to Georgia.
When did you get your first real lead as to who was involved in the assassination? Your first lead.
Well, I mean, it was evolving developments. I thought Earl Clark, who was a captain of the police department, was involved. He was a very good shooter on the police force and very, very, very much a racist. Turned out he wasn't. He was only acting as a spotter for the shooter, who was another policeman who was an excellent shot. Bits and pieces of information started to come from various witnesses all along. So it's not easy. When we ran a mock trial in 1993, our research and investigation produced results which led us in the direction of the Army being there. And they were there with an 8-man squad as backups. But they also had 2 photographers on the roof of the roof of the fire station. So it all developed gradually and was put together gradually.
Where did you first start to notice the involvement of Lloyd Jowers?
Well, Jowers was always a question because he owned the grill, which from back of which the shot took place, and he was always in the frame, but we never put him so directly in it as when he carried the smoking rifle into the back of the kitchen, broke it down, then took it out and put it on a shelf in the restaurant. Jowers' secret was kept by Betty Spates from 1968 to 1994, when I was able to break her down, and she told me the story of Lloyd. And what she thought Lloyd had done.
Now, Lloyd Jowers, he was also he was a former police officer before becoming the proprietor of the Jim's Grill. He had made some connections with the local mafia, right?
Yes, he was very close to Frank Liberto, who hired him to do this job. Owed a lot of money to Liberto. That debt got forgiven, and he put $100,000 in an unused stove. And he bought a taxi cab company after the assassination. So he was well in with them. His gambling debt was forgiven, and he was given quite a bit of money to cooperate.
Okay. So, in terms of Lloyd's involvement in the assassination, could you comment a little bit more about what you've been able to piece together that what he did in that critical couple of hours during and after the assassination?
Well, It's sort of difficult to provide all the details. We knew that James was the patsy. We knew that Jowers had involvement because he brought the smoking rifle in. Earl Clark, who was out there as a spotter, went down over the wall. He was seen by a taxi driver who was killed that evening. The shooter was a fellow named Frank Strouser, and Jowers was reluctant to name him, and we only got his name gradually over a period of time from Lenny Curtis, who was a janitor at the rifle range, where he saw Strouser get the special rifle and practice with it all day. Before leaving around 3 p.m. This is what we know in terms of setting up the shooting that was taken from the bushes in the back area of the rooming house and Jim's Grill.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. In case you've just joined us, we're speaking with Dr. William Pepper. He is the human rights lawyer, most known for his defense of James Earl Ray in the trial of the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., and the author of three books, the most recent being The Plot to Kill King, The Truth Behind the Assassination of Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. William Pepper, I'm wondering if we could also talk about the various ways in which the King delegation in Memphis had been somewhat set up. The fact that, for example, he had been asked to change or made to change rooms from a more secure area at the Lorraine Motel to one where he would be exposed on the balcony. Can you maybe provide us some insights as to how and why those, because that figures into the overall conspiracy too, right?
Yeah, the Dixie Mafia family, and in fact the wife of the leader of that family, received a phone call sometime shortly before the 4th of April, because King had only arrived there, and he was placed in room 202, which was a secure room. But she received a phone call and from her her son, who along with Frank Holloman was running the operation, the assassination operation, and she was asked to go to talk to one of the Adkins employees, was a black fella called OZ, and she was asked to call him, ask him to get to Jesse Jackson, and ask Jackson to go to the owner of the motel and move the room. Her son was there at the time that she took the call when she was making the arrangements, and she discussed it with him. So that the son was my informant of those events. Martin was moved to room 306,
mm-hmm.
where it was an open area and a clear target.
Yes.
And that's really what was required. When that happened, Mrs. Bailey, after the shot, Mrs. Bailey realized what she had done. She actually managed the motel. And she said, oh, my God, what have I done? She ran to her room and collapsed, had a cerebral hemorrhage, and was taken to the St. Joseph's Hospital where she died about 5 days later. So the room change was organized by the conspirators and was thus carried out.
Okay. Now, there's also the fact that there's a major, you know, involvement on the part of, you know, other figures that would have acted as backup in case this sniper in the bushes had missed. Can you talk about how that was organized?
You're talking about the backup?
Yes.
Well,
the backup shooters.
The Army had an 8-man team in Memphis as a backup unit. They were instructed at Camp, they came from Camp Shelby in Mississippi. And they were given their instructions, and they left around 4:30 in the morning. They were shown two photographs, one of Andy Young and one of Martin King. Those were the targets. They were told they were enemies of the state. They drove in and took up positions, one on the roof of the fire station, and we believe the other one on the water tower, each with a spotter, and they were waiting. If the civilian shooter did not do the job, they were prepared to do it. They were not going to let Martin King ever get to Memphis. He was too dangerous. I mean, from Memphis to Washington. He was too dangerous, and they were not going to allow that. They allow him to bring 500,000 people who could turn into a revolutionary mob. So they were determined to kill him one way or the other. They had the initial plan with the with Strausser as a civilian, quote, civilian, he was always a police officer, shooter, and the army was backing him up in case he couldn't get the job done.
Mm. Some other details relating to the conspiracy, the fact that police, that there had been some irregularities in terms of arranging for police to not be at or near the scene in the run-up to the assassination?
Well, I'm sorry, let me have that question again, exactly what you want.
Okay, well, I'm just wanting to clarify some other details that, irregularities in terms of police being called off their normal rounds, in the lead-up to the assassination on April 4th.
Well, that day, the two black firemen at the local fire station were replaced. They were told to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. King's usual black bodyguard unit was kept in the police station. They were not involved. So they were taking all the necessary precautions to make sure that the effort would go off promptly and smoothly and without any eyewitness observations. They also had two photographers put on the roof. That was the military side of it. Two photographers put on the roof to shoot the back of the Lorraine Motel at the time of the shooting. One was to shoot up the balcony, the other was to shoot on the ground. And he was the one who brought his camera around into the bushes and actually caught the shooter lowering his rifle. The shooter, he said, who was not James Earl Ray.
Mm. There was also the issue of, on the morning of April 5th, the next day, they had sent up a crew to clear the bushes near the grill from the location where some witnesses had seen the shooter. That also
They sent a cleanup crew in from the Public Works Department to clean up the entire back area, which was filled with high bushes and brush. And they cut all that down, and they cleaned it up thoroughly so that it would never appear that a shooter could be there without being spotted. So they took all of the brushes off, and even one tree limb, I think, was cut down. So they made it a safe haven for the shooter.
Mm.
And he then was able to escape running back through the back of the building along the side of it, because it was a vacant lot along the side and out onto the sidewalk.
Mm. That was there any concern? I mean, the fact is, as I understand it, like the Memphis Police Department had ordered, sent out the orders to clean up that area, which was credibly accused crime scene. So that's an irregularity for which there was no official explanation, if I'm not mistaken.
No, there was no official explanation. There was no public knowledge that it was done. And they cut back a large intervening bush between the fire station and a vacant lot, because if that bush had been there, then their story of James having seen a police car and panicked and dropping the bundle in front of a store would have been, would have held true. Without that bush there, James could have seen the police car. But with the bush there, even if there was a police car, there was no way he could have seen it.
Now, going back to the assassination itself, the shot took place at 6:01. An ambulance came and took him to St. Joseph's Hospital. Now, could you maybe comment on that choice of hospital? Why King would have been taken there as opposed to another location?
Well, it was fairly close, but it wasn't as close as a couple of other hospital facilities. But, of course, they had to take him to St. Joseph's because that was, if it became necessary, that was where they were going to make sure that he didn't leave alive.
Uh-huh. Could you expand on that? What happened from what you've been able to determine, what happened from the time of the arrival at the hospital, St. Joseph Hospital, that evening?
Well, he was moved into the emergency room. Eventually, not immediately, but eventually they began to work on him, and they were trying to identify pieces of paper that had been dropped so that they could know their way out at the right time. But for the time being, they were ensconced in the hospital. Raoul was there as well with them. And it's important to know about Raoul was that he didn't have his passport with him, and yet he was on the list of the people who should leave the city as quickly as possible. So that was the escape area that they had left Frank Solomon and his crowd. Now, as you back out of here, you will tend to see Lara syndrome.
Okay, could you, there was an unusual, according to your book, there was an unusual number of military or intelligence people in the inside the hospital?
Yes, they got there early and they identified everybody. They knew every nurse and every doctor. They were very well informed and supposedly protective, although they weren't being protective. They were effectively there to facilitate whatever Dr. Breen Bland wanted to do, and he was the one who took control of the room and control of the operation in the hospital. And he had been, he's the Adkins family doctor. He had been out with the Adkins family a couple of weeks before, and he insisted that they have that the group have a strong position with respect to covering up the assassination by Strausser.
Okay, so the again, according to your book, Strausser, who you identified as the shooter, actually didn't kill King. That King appears to have, or the job was finished, you might say, inside that hospital. In his last moments alive, who was with King?
Well, Dr. Bland, they chased everyone out of the room. As they were going out, the last one leaving was the nurse, Shelby. She heard them gathering spit up in their mouths and had caught her attention as she was at the door going out. She then turned around, saw the three men, two in suits, and Dr. Bland. She saw the three of them spit on the body. That was when she saw Bland take a pillow and put the pillow over Dr. King's face and effectively suffocating him. The next morning when she went home at 11 o'clock, she called her family around and said, I don't know why they had to kill him. And then she told them the story. And it was years later, of course, that I deposed her, one of her sons, who knew the whole story from his mother, and who, under oath and video transcription, told us exactly what had happened to Dr. King. He was killed in the emergency room. He might have died anyway. He was badly injured by the bullet, but they were not taking any chances. There was no way they were going to let him bring the mob into Washington. They were afraid it could turn into a revolutionary situation.
So a high-level conspiracy. There's a somewhat interest, yet another interesting aspect to this case, this idea that it wasn't just happenstance that King happened to be in Memphis, that he was somehow drawn there, that the sanitation workers' strike itself was bait for this trap of getting him to Memphis specifically. Could you comment on that?
Well, the sanitation workers' strike was the reason that he came to Memphis. That's true. The sanitation workers were determined to strike independently of Dr. King, but two of their members had been crushed on a rainy day in the back of the garbage truck where they went for shelter. They weren't allowed to go into regular shelters that other workers used in Memphis. And they were crushed in the back of the garbage truck by a man who was a member of of the Atkins group. That precipitated a great deal of anger, sympathy, compassion for the strikers, and Dr. King determined that he was going to go and do the best that he could on their behalf. He went to lead an a march which became disrupted and abortive, so he went back to Atlanta, decided to come again and do a work with one of the black radical groups to try to make it a peaceful march. And that black black radical group, the Invaders, were also told to leave the hotel about 15 minutes before the assassination. They were dangerous. They could have seen something. They also were armed. So the plotters decided to get them out of there, and they were ordered out of the hotel.
Mm-hmm. There was just in the last few years, it's as I understand it, that you came across. This is since the civil trial that you represented on behalf of the King family. You came up with this new information that pointed you in the direction of this Frank Strausser, and this comes down to an individual whose identity you kept secret until he died. Could you tell us more about that last tidbit of information, which really helps complete the picture?
Well, Lenny Curtis is the man's name, and he was a janitor in the rifle range of the police department. And that's where Strausser and Clark used to work and hang out. He saw a special rifle come in and be given to Strausser. And he saw Strausser on the day of the assassination practicing all day with that rifle. And then he saw him leave around 3 o'clock. And Strausser had at various times said King was going to get his head blown off, that type of thing. So he was suspicious of Strausser. He also found that they were suspicious of him. And they kept him under surveillance, unmarked car outside of his house. excuse me. He was lighting a cigarette going into his house one day, and he smelled gas. He had to put the cigarette out. He saw a V sign in a tree above his, behind his kitchen window. And then finally, the final straw was Strauser asked him to come with him, ride with him downtown when he was going to pick up paychecks for the men. And on the way down, he didn't go the usual route. He went through a wooded area, and he showed his gun by brushing his coat back and asked Lenny who he thought, what he thought about Ray being the murderer of Dr. King. And Lenny quickly said, yes, of course he was. Everything points to him. He was, of course, speaking for his life. So down, they went down, they came back. But he had enough suspicion of Strauser from the background information and experience and then the shooting and practicing of the rifle all day long. But I couldn't use, I deposed Lenny, put him under oath, and transcribed him and videotaped him. But we couldn't use that. We couldn't use that until he died. Because I had no doubt that they would kill him. So we kept that as a part of our gathering information, but quietly held.
Mm. So... William Pepper, could you comment then on what makes this case so important in terms of helping us understand the ability of ordinary citizens to confront power in our society? What is the particular significance of this assassination and cover-up?
Well... Because of the evidence we've uncovered, there's no question that this was a government operation. And it was an operation led by the FBI, by J. Edgar Hoover, using his number two, Tolson, and using the head of police and fire in Memphis, Frank Holloman, who used to work in Hoover's office and who, toward the end, became very involved in the detail of the assassination. So it was a government operation using a local Dixie Mafia people and a local hitman with strong government backup. So that we know. We know government can do that. Government did do that. What average citizens can do is really to try to pay attention to their government and what they're doing, what the officials are doing, and be as well informed as possible about that. And also, I think, probably move to change the whole culture of this country from materialism and capitalism and militarism into something much more humane. And that would require really extensive work on amending the Constitution of the United States. And it's that's a task, but it's a task, that, in my view, that must be undertaken at some point in time. But an alert citizenry is essential for the salvation of a democracy. And unfortunately, in America, we don't have that alert citizenry yet. Hopefully, with cases like this coming to the foreground, we will be able to have it.
I have just one last question because I know you got to go, but there has not been a lot of respectful media attention paid towards the case that you've put forward. Could you comment on why that is so?
Well, the corporate media in America, for the most part, does not want to cover cases like this. Corporate media is determined to keep the status quo and the credibility of governmental agents. You can imagine what the people would think if they knew that their government agencies were acting in this way, not only domestically, of course, but internationally, as they have been. So that's really the case. It's been a cover-up by the mainstream media, which is corporate controlled. There may be a breakthrough on that with the new Washington Post doing a major feature on this case, either coming out either on this Sunday or Monday. So one might look for it. But let me encourage people to try to get the copy of the book, The Plot to Kill King, anyway, because that's the one way to get the truth about this case. I put in every deposition, every piece of testimony that's evidentiary value. It's all there in that one book. So any students of history are free to read it and revise this nation's history with respect to at least this case.
Well, Dr. William Pepper, I did have the great fortune 9 years ago of meeting and interviewing King's speechwriter, Vincent Harding, and I now can add to that, having had the opportunity to interview another key figure in his life, William Pepper. So thank you so much for agreeing to this interview, and I do hope we can speak again at some point.
Okay, thank you very much.
That was William Pepper, human rights lawyer and author of 3 books on the assassination of Martin Luther King. William Pepper has also represented Sirhan Sirhan in the trial for the murder of Senator and 1968 presidential candidate Robert Kennedy, another instance believed to be a high-level conspiracy in which the official assassin is believed to be a patsy or scapegoat to conceal the conspiracy. William Pepper's website is williampepper.com. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour, podcast at globalresearch.ca and airing on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. Some of our content airs occasionally through Rabble Radio and can be found at rabble.ca. To leave feedback on our program, please email us at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. In a final commemoration to the death of one of America's most iconic civil rights heroes, we'll air a song by the legendary Nina Simone. The song was performed at the Westbury Music Festival on Long Island, New York, within days of Dr. King's assassination. Composed by Miss Simone's bass player, Gene Taylor, it's called Why the King of Love is Dead. The Global Research News Hour will return in 7 days. Thank you for joining us.
Once upon this planet Earth lived a man of humble birth, preaching love and freedom for his fellow man. He was dreaming of the day peace would come to earth to stay, and he spread this message all across the land. Turn the other cheek, he'd plead. Love thy neighbor was his creed. Pain, humiliation, death, he did not dread. With his Bible at his side, from his foes he did not hide. It's hard to think this great man is dead.